and welcome to World Apart. When Russia entered the Ukrainian conflict more than 3 years ago, the Kremlin said it was in part to avoid a bigger war in Europe. With Russia and Ukraine now starting to talk about talking, does it mean that the threat of a larger conflict, even another world war, is now behind us? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Biljana Vankovska, professor of political science and international relations at St. Cyril and Methodius University in North Macedonia. Professor Vankovska, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know that you've been researching and writing about peace and reconciliation for many decades, and it's evident from your writing that you treat peace as a great value, genuinely, as a worthy goal to work for, rather than a rhetorical tool or some geopolitical ploy. Now, given all these commotions surrounding the talks in Istanbul, do you think the sides are approaching peace in the same way that you are approaching it?
Unfortunately, I have to give you a negative answer, because all my knowledge, and even if I may use my personal experience as someone who comes from a former war-torn region, former Yugoslavia, everything that I see and have seen so far speaks about not quite serious attitude of the involved parties. There is no good faith, there is no strategy, and as you rightly pointed out, there is no understanding what peace means. In peace theory and practice of conflict resolution, we talk about diagnosis, prognosis, and therapy. And nowadays, actually, we face a turning point. Until recently, it was almost a blasphemy to even mention peace plan or peace negotiations. All of a sudden, things seem to turn upside down. So now everybody is trying to present himself, themselves as peacemakers, but they're doing that in such a contradictory manner that I'm not hopeful that this is the right path to sustainable peace.
And I want to mention that we are recording this conversation on Thursday morning, and the peace talks in Istanbul were supposed to begin about an hour ago, but it's still up in the air whether they will happen or not. We are hearing that the Russian delegation is in Turkey, but the Ukrainians have not yet arrived. The delegation, the president of Ukraine is in Turkey, but he is still undecided about how to proceed. So we still don't know, actually, whether the talks will take place. Now, why do you think all this posturing? Because, I mean, ultimately, the Ukrainians are the ones who are suffering the most. They should be interested in, you know, at least putting their demands on the table rather than playing this hard-to-get game.
I have a feeling that we focus as a general public more on personalities and believe that, for example, Trump is able to provide peace, to make peace, because he is a strong man from Washington. On the other hand, we give too much credit to Vladimir Zelensky, that he is some kind of participant into these talks. Unfortunately, I believe that Zelensky is just a puppet, and there are forces behind that I already mentioned are not very, I cannot see them as honest brokers, because they have been involved into this proxy war for 3 years and more than that. So you cannot expect someone who had been involved and is still involved into providing military support, assistance, intelligence, targeting, drones, and everything that we have seen, all at a sudden, overnight, to become a peacemaker or to show a goodwill, good faith into engaging into real discussion about peace process. that's why I have actually pictured President Zelensky as a main character of a Western movie from the Wild West, you know, a cowboy who is going out to meet his adversary and to handle things, man.
Yeah, I know you compared him to Gary Cooper, but, you know, the problem here is that he's not on stage. It's the real people who are dying on the battlefields or who are suffering because, you know, Ukraine is wasting its resources on this never-ending war for not a clear reason. Now, I heard one of the Russian experts describe this whole situation as phantasmagoria, and I think that's perhaps an apt word because from the very beginning, this conflict was based on a lot of fantasies about, you know, the West delivering a strategic defeat to Russia, Ukraine being the defender or perhaps a martyr for the free world. Do you think those fantasies have now been defeated or are they still operating in the minds of decision makers?
I believe that they are still ongoing, transforming, redefining, but still one should start from facing the reality. And these people are not ready to face the reality. They speak about, as you mentioned, strategic defeat. They have, first of all, no clear goals in this process, short-term, mid-term, long-term, and how from one phase you can go through the second one in order to achieve a sustainable peace. I think that these people look like amateurs and the real diplomacy is somewhere marginalized and real diplomats and real negotiators are diminished. And honestly, I'm not flattering here the Russian public, but I truly believe that Mr. Lavrov has no real counterpart on the other side, not to mention President Putin, of course.
But it's not even about them personally, as you mentioned. It's about the treatment of the discipline of diplomacy or the discipline of the statecraft. Now, I want to ask you about that because in your analysis, you often draw parallels between what happened to some of the Balkan states and Ukraine in terms of being groomed by Western state builders to the point when there are state fully lost the capacity to act in their own self-interest or even to assess the situation in objective terms, not in terms of their wishful thinking or some, you know, fantastical ideas about democracy, but the real facts on the ground. And I would claim that perhaps Ukraine went much further than many other states in terms of being, you know, absolutely led astray out of reality by the Western sponsors. How do you explain this phenomenon of, you know, putting so much on the line when your entire country is being decimated and not even realizing what for?
There is a big difference between the geopolitical positioning of the former Yugoslavia and its successor state. So that sort of state building was of a different sort throughout a longer period of time. Here we have Ukraine. Ukraine was in the cart of the West since early 90s of 20th century. So Euromaidan did not happen, you know, out of people's will. It was a colored revolution. It was designed. So everything that followed, Minsk agreements were a farce, as we know now, thanks to the confession of Angela Merkel. So Ukraine has a very important strategic position for the West, and they still think of themselves as hegemon. So here, the situation is much more dangerous in terms of escalation. And that's why these negotiations should have taken a different dynamic. And so far, we have seen actually even Germany suffering from the blow-up of the Nord Stream, for example, and they did not react it at all. And now they suffer the economic consequences. So Europe is self-defeating in this whole mess, not even caring about its own interest of the European people. And my diagnosis as a political scientist is that we deal here with very dangerous people because they belong to so-called kakistocracy, a rule of people who are least incompetent, very unscrupulous, and really we don't know whether they are serious or not in playing all these games. And that's why they are putting in danger the entire world.
If you allow me, I would also want to suggest another theory here or another explanation, because I'm studying psychological, active psychology on the side. And if I were to use psychological terms, I think under the name of independence, Ukraine and many other countries are falling for the most malignant form of codependence. And one feature of codependence is psychosis, when you cannot tell, genuinely, you cannot tell the difference between material reality and your phantasms about it. But that raises a very important question for Russia, whether Ukraine indeed realistically can be treated as a sovereign actor. That is, if it can be trusted to engage in talks in good faith and, you know, uphold any of the terms if they are agreed and negotiated.
Your knowledge of psychology and probably colleagues, social and political psychologists and even clinical psychologists would have been of great help to help us understand with whom we are dealing with or speaking from the Russian side, Kremlin deals with whether these people are really disconnected from reality, or are they insane or just delusioned, because some others behind them are encouraging them to do stupid things. So yes, I would agree with that proposal to look that situation from that point of view. Here, Ukraine is no actor at all. And even if they sit at the table, I'm sure that somebody is going to whispering into their ear what is good to accept or not. And I haven't seen a real understanding of the very serious situation in Ukraine. As you mentioned, they're losing the ground. They're losing manpower. The public opinion is changing, but of course the media would not allow that side to be heard widely. So how the society behaves is easy to understand. It is a psychosis, but also media propaganda. Media propaganda supported by Western donors, NGOs. We have the same effect in my part of the world because we come now from a NATO part of family. So there is a total brainwashing and actually listening only to one side of the story, not the other side.
Well, Professor Vankovska, we have to stay connected to the reality. That's why we are going to take a very, very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy.
Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are you living on, man?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Biljana Vankovska, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at St. Cyril and Methodius University in North Macedonia. Professor Vankovska, just before the break, we were talking about our doubts whether Ukraine can act in good faith and in its own self-interest. And you kept mentioning the sponsors and the European Union that is encouraging Ukraine to go on with the fighting. And I think that brings up an important chicken and egg question, whether any peace deal on Ukraine is possible or realistic without Russia and Europe sitting down, you know, in some format and negotiating the future security architecture in Europe.
Actually, I was very happy to hear, even I'm not fan of President Trump, to be honest, I was happy to hear that there were these first moves of normalization and talks, re-establishing the diplomatic talks between Washington and Moscow. That is good for the world peace. Now you mentioned the European actor, and here we see this somehow confused, erratic West that is divided and sometimes united, and they are like in a nightmare of a bad divorce when two partners don't know who is in charge and who wants what. So here in this situation, with all my skepticism about the sincerity of Washington, I would find the European partners being peace spoilers. We saw that during the Victory Day, this adolescent behavior of the leading European politicians behaving as in a party, and it doesn't look like they see the whole seriousness of the suffering of the Ukrainian people and, of course, the whole battlefield. So Europe is now a strange phenomenon. I cannot say European Union because UK is back in the company. Then we say we see all these different formats of negotiating within the so-called European family. So it is very hard to define who Europe is right now and how they go through all these, I would say, rather worrisome militaristic transformations, call for rearming Europe, or German Chancellor calling for making Germany military force again.
Absolutely. Professor Vankovsky, can I ask you about that? Because, I mean, we can all, you know, dismiss, you know, the folly of the European leadership, you know, strategic advice or the value of that advice. But I think Russia, more than any other country, is very apprehensive when it hears European leaders talking about the need to rearm themselves in order to, you know, fight a war with Russia, you know, a couple of years down the line. And that's a very serious strategic threat to Moscow. And, you know, it would also figure in all the discussions about the Ukrainian conflict, because ultimately Russia wants to, you know, finish with war fighting once and for all. It doesn't want to encounter a bigger enemy a few years down the line. When you hear Europeans talking about arming themselves for a conflict with Russia, how serious do you think they are?
Well, they are serious and not quite serious. Again, we have this confusion there because not me, but much more experienced military experts say, first of all, there is no money in this plan of Ursula von der Leyen, then in order to rearm Europe in a way they envisage, it would take at least 8 to 10 years. So this is nothing realistic, and still they're boasting that they're going to confront Russia. Here, I would add the NATO factor. NATO is some kind of market for weapons, for American weapons, first of all. So they are playing with the fears of the people of their own societies, because the money that for rearming Europe will come from the state budgets. And that means less money for people, for social needs, and more money for weapons. They are playing with the fear in order to make consent in their own societies, because Russia is the danger. And they put it as a strategic threat.
But I'm sure you would agree with me that this kind of game playing has its own very dangerous consequences. I heard you say in another interview that when a country invests more in military security, it inevitably undermines its social security or increases the risk of political instability, simply because the resources are limited. And if you attend to, you know, certain things, you are not attending to other things. Why do you think the European leaders are so oblivious to the threat of social unrest at home, especially given how much they have invested themselves in stirring upheavals like color revolutions abroad?
Well, that's a very difficult question, because what concerns me the most is the fact that Europe is a cradle of two world wars. And if we go back and follow this transformation of societies going from one war into another, it's a very scary thing. It's hard to explain anything but this line: follow the money, where the profit gets. It is in the military-industrial complex. And obviously, Ursula von der Leyen and Macron and Schultz they all have in mind rebuilding of the European sustainable military buildup and military industry. And here, some people will gain a lot of money out of Russian fear.
Now, both of us, we come from former federalist states. You come from Yugoslavia. I was born in the Soviet Union. And both of these state entities disintegrated because of misaligned priorities. Because, for example, the Soviet Union is well known. It invested too much in the military-industrial complex at the cost of providing basic services to its people. Do you think the European Union ran the risks of going down that track?
Absolutely. The voters' behavior in some particular states in European Union shows that. And they are blacklisted, they are on the verge to be banned, so democracy is curtailed, people are shut up, intellectuals are cancelled. So it is ongoing process. In social sciences, we tend to think about developments in wider terms, as structural problems, not personality problems. And these things don't happen overnight. This is ongoing process of deterioration of the democracy, of stability, of legitimacy of the European governments. And for good or bad, at some point, the people will say, enough is enough. So we cannot go on like this. So we just need to see how it will end up, because everything is in disarray, even in the European Union.
Now, I know that your own country, North Macedonia, was once called an oasis of peace because it gained its independence relatively peacefully. But a lot of your neighbors did go to war with one another or had internal conflicts. And I want to ask you, as a social scientist, do you think some degree of bloodshed is inevitable when you have these large state entities collapse or disintegrate?
I still believe that there have been chances to avoid the bloody collapse of Yugoslavia that I still consider my homeland. My I was born in that country. I love that. So that at that time, we had a lot of good analysis of peace researchers, especially from the northern part of Europe, who said it could have been prevented. It could have avoided military military conflict, but some Western countries were already involved in their strategic thinking, especially around Slovenia, Croatia, and so on and so forth. So everything can be, and especially Ukraine, let me just remind and emphasize that was the most predictable and most preventable conflict in Europe in the recent years. So it was made by intent. I'm sure it was not spontaneous, you know, that things were just going out of control. No, somebody wanted the war.
Now, let me ask you about another breakup that has already happened, and this is the breakup in the so-called United West, because it is pretty clear that Washington and Brussels are no longer as united as they used to be 3 years ago. Where do you see the transatlantic relationship going within the next 5 to 10 years? Do you think it will be back to normal, so to say, when Trump leaves office?
Some people believe that Trump would disband NATO, but that's not the right prognosis, because NATO is a source of profit for the U.S. military industry. But NATO is not what it used to be or was presented some years ago. Let me remind you that NATO lost the war in Afghanistan and NATO lost the war in Ukraine too. So despite all this role-playing and rebranding that is happening now, it was NATO member states that were engaged, and Ukraine was a de facto NATO country, even in the first mandate of Donald Trump, if not before. So it was rearmed by the West, taken care by the West, instead of nurturing this neutrality that Ukraine initially had as a strategic option. They actually pushed it into this NATO embrace and militarized it. So NATO depends on the wish of the White House. Without United States, there is no NATO, and Europeans are totally irrelevant and totally impotent in military terms, as
well,
I mentioned
before.
They
may be irrelevant and impotent in military terms, but they're still causing a lot of trouble economically and geopolitically. Just very quickly, I think at least when it comes to Ukraine, Russia will take care of its own interests. And I think Ukraine, in one way or another, will be under control and hopefully pacified. But do you think NATO would be pressed to find another country to sort of court and benefit from to keep this military-industrial complex, you know, running and devouring resources?
They are addicted to war, and fortunately the West knows much more about making wars rather than peace. Unlike the rest of the world, who is trying to work on economic globalization, trade, cooperation, multipolarity, the West is addicted, and addiction is a very hard thing to really cure.
So, especially if you don't recognize that it exists.
Absolutely, yes. The first thing is to recognize that I am an addict and I should take care of myself. So we are going to see more interesting developments in the future, unfortunately.
Well, Professor Vankovska, this is all we have time for. Thank you very much for this very interesting conversation.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart next week.